Very welcome, all of you. First of all, a word of warning. The microphones are on. So if you think too loud, it will be broadcasted all over the globe. If you lean over with some comments to Henry, we will record that then. Well, this is a meeting which is broadcasted, so you're aware of that. Doesn't change very much for us. I propose we leave the microphones on. We can speak freely, but not more than that. We are a bit lucky. We can be a little bit informal. If needed, let's use the raising of the sign as a sign of speech. And the topic is revenue recognition in case of someone has got into the wrong room. I got into this room 2004 and learned that in October 2004 we published exposure draft on revenue. We didn't, but we have spent a lot of time and we have had a lot of discussions, and I think we have learned a lot in the meantime. Now we have 950 something letters to read. And some will read them more carefully than others. I hope April and a few more, even though we have an ambition, all of us, to read them. I hope we will have a good couple of topics here now and a good discussion. We from the board and from PASP, Larry is here, we will try to avoid to go into a defensive mood. And we hope that you will explain a little bit more so we get the full understanding for why we are here. We have to end this 2:30, but I think we have time enough for to have a good discussion. And April will take us through the different topics. And the topics are hopefully topics that you have asked to bring up. And we have allowed a little extra time for the control topic, which seems to be a lot of interest in. And for the other topics, we have roughly 15 minutes. And I will try to avoid to be too blunt, but after roughly 15 minutes, we have to move on if we are going to cover these topics. So, why don't we go quickly around the table and present ourselves, where we come from, and also, if possible, a word of your expectations of this meeting.
Good afternoon. My name is Kenny Beamont, FASB staff, and I'm one of the privileged few who will read and analyze all of the comment letters, and we've started that process, and the I think there's some very good issues raised in these comment letters. So in these roundtable discussions, I very much look forward to your hearing your suggestions on how to resolve these issues, and I'm sure we can do it.
Stephen Cooper, ISB, looking forward to you giving us all the answers.
Nicholas Sabati, Siemens AG, working in the accounting policies group. I think our main issue is how this final document might apply to construction type contracts, and that is, I guess, our main focus.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Ramana from India, JV Institute of Management. My interests are more from a research point of view, but I have a specific interest on utilities, particularly the power sector. I'd like to listen to and get views of Alpha Ones. Thank you very much.
Ruth Picker, I'm the global leader of our IFRS services group. I'm hoping to see if there's some clarity around the concept of continuous transfer and some other areas where we have concerns about how to make the standard operational.
Larry Smith from the FASB, and my expectations are that you tell us what your concerns are relative to the operationality of the standard.
Henry Rees from the ISB staff, like my colleagues, looking forward to hearing your suggestions as to how we resolve some of these thorny issues.
Brian O'Donovan from KPMG, interested to explain some of our concerns, particularly around the control concept, to hear if those concerns are shared and to be corrected if we dissent instead.
This is Knoll, German Accounting Standards Board. I hope that we can contribute to more clarity and even further improvement.
François Flavetti, Frac. I hope we were able to share the concerns that have been raised, but also share where improvements have been identified so that we can implement the way forward.
Frédéric Duneau, I represent a group of European companies in the software industry, including Dassault Systèmes, SAP, Nokia, Sage, Alcatel-Lucent, Mysis, and Software AD. And I'm basically here to discuss issues pertaining to our industry, the software industry.
And we'll go from ISP, come to listen to your views.
Andrew Buchan, Global Head of IFRS at BDO. I think what I'd like to see us get to is some solutions to a number of the issues. They're looking at the comment letters, there's a degree of commonality among them. I would have a particular interest in the contract segmentation and, like others, a little bit more clarity over continuous transfer.
I'm Phil Barden. I work for Deloitte, but I'm here representing the English Institute. I guess I'm keen to focus on those areas where I think the exposure draft isn't sufficiently clear so that we can avoid ambiguity in application, and also on some of the areas where it might produce answers that don't really seem to reflect the underlying economics and whether it's possible to do something about that.
Glenn Brady from the ISB project staff, and looking forward to hearing your views.
April Pittman, ISB staff, looking forward to hearing a lively discussion with a diverse range of views, I think.
It is April who will take us through the afternoon, so April.
Okay, thank you, Anne. We've arranged the agenda to concentrate on the topics which the majority of you have requested, and we'll try to keep fairly informally to that agenda because we do want to leave time at the end for each of you to summarise your views and give general comments or to raise any topics which you specifically want to discuss. We hope to hear as many views as possible. So in discussing a topic, if you broadly agree with the previous speaker, then just say that you agree and raise any additional comments which you would like to make. And in that way, we'll get through as many individual points as possible. The roundtable is being webcast, as Jan said, so it might be helpful if each of you could state your name and the organization you're representing when you speak, and that will help listeners follow the discussion and the tenure of the discussion. The first item on the agenda, and one which is concerned, I think, to many, many people in the comment letters, is control. There's an extract of the key principles in the exposure draft on the agenda. The principle is that revenue is recognized as a good or service transferred to the customer. And in the exposure draft, the tool used to tell you when that transfer takes place is control. Now, that control concept works very well, I think, with goods being delivered to the customer. But when we go down the route of looking at services or a part completed good, people do seem to think that control may not be as useful. And so the use of control to determine when transfer has taken place does vary depending on what the object of the contract is. There are also some people have raised concern about the control principle and how the indicators support that and need to supplement it. As I've said, service contracts in particular tend to be an issue. And also, what characteristics are there in a contract which would make you think that control was passing continuously to the customer? That's an area which is problematic for some people. So I don't know if anyone would like to kick off from control's perspective. Perhaps, Phil, I know you were speaking earlier.
Yes, I'm very happy to. Phil Barden from the English Institute. I guess I would divide this into two sections, really. There is a need to work out, for any particular circumstances, what answer you should get to. And obviously, as standard setters, you'll want to have your frameworks in mind to be happy that the answers you get to are the right sort of answers. I think there is then a separate question of how, once you've worked that out, you translate that into an accounting standard that's written in a way that's actually intelligible to a very wide range of people. Because compared to some other standards, which can be quite specialist because they are mainly only used by specialists, this standard will actually be of great interest to a very wide range of people. It's actually pretty important that, for example, people working in sales departments who may not naturally be accountants will at least be able to get to grips with this, because they will need to actually draft contracts in a way that gets to the right sort of answers for their companies. So I would divorce the two, and I think it's important to focus on the how you get to the answer first, and then secondly how you make it understandable. For me, April's exactly right on that first question. The service contracts, the part complete goods, are the difficult area. You can think of that as being a question about work in progress, if you like. There's something that's part complete but not complete. And it does seem perfectly reasonable to me to approach that by saying, whose asset is this? Because ultimately the accounting is probably going to show that as an asset of one party or the other. I'm not certain that control is the best word to use when you're trying to answer the question, whose asset is this? But that's something that I'm sure we should explore. But I guess the main point I'd make here is around the principle and the indicators. The principle is not terribly easy to digest as currently drafted. I think different people have managed to read it in different ways. And the indicators are not terribly clearly tied back to the principle. If I was to pick on one of them, I would pick on the customer-specific principle. It's not immediately obvious why that should be considered an indicator of control, or rather it's not explicitly obvious why that should be an indicator of control. And I could make arguments as to why it should be, but I hear other people make different arguments as to why it should be. So I think that would be a very useful thing to focus on.
I think I agree with you, and we have also, Nicolas Stavati, Siemens. We have also looked at the interpretation of control, meaning that design of function could be an element that defines the control. And I think our conclusion would be that there might be different interpretations, but we think this is an interpretation you can make. And if the board makes that interpretation, we are more than happy to accept that interpretation, because it allows us to apply what we call POC to some contracts where we think POC accounting results in the right decision, useful information for investors, because this is how we perform under the contract. So we don't have, as I said, big feelings. We think this is an interpretation that is workable and it's important for us. What we think might be difficult if you apply that, if you look to the, I think it's to the application guidance where you have, where you look at when control transfers to the customer, that customer acceptance may have a big influence, because you objectively have to determine whether control has transferred to the customer or not. And our discussions with auditors have revealed that some auditors might interpret that as being that someone, a third party, must look at that contract and maybe say, okay, control has transferred to the customer. And we don't think that customer acceptance clauses in many ways are just a formality, but it's an important thing. And sometimes it's even a thing of debate between the customer and the company. So focusing on that element might result in not recognizing revenue for highly individualized contracts until the end, basically, of the contract, until the customer has accepted that. And that is, I think, our main focus with the control notion.
I would just like to point out that we agree that the control concept is difficult to apply to services. I would just add the precision that it's also very difficult to apply for the sale of intangible assets. And that's probably why, one of the reasons why we believe we were more comfortable with the risk and rewards model. And we find the control model difficult to apply, and we feel that we would benefit from further guidance on control indicators.
What do you find better about risk and rewards that you don't find in control?
And to be perfectly honest, it may be just a matter of we were used to it, because I have to admit that it requires a lot of judgment today, and maybe it's a function of we are used to that model and we know how to apply it. So we're not rejecting the control model, we're just pointing out that we we think it's going to be difficult to apply in our industry. And you know, when you look at the indicators that have been provided, I think there's pretty much only one or two that are truly applicable to the sale of the software. The other ones are irrelevant in our business.
Ruth Picker from Ernst & Young. I think, first of all, we support the model, the five-step model. We think that's a good model to work with. I did want to say that up front because we've been looking for a consistent revenue recognition model and we think it's an improvement on IS 18. But we do have some issues with control, the definition of control, and the outcome of applying the control concept. And just in answer, April, to where do we think a risk and rewards model might get you a better answer is in an example such as where the customer has a put option to put the asset back to you. Under the control model, you would recognise revenue because the customer controls the asset. But under a risk and rewards model, you wouldn't, because you would say it has the ability to put it back to you, so you wouldn't recognise the sale at all. And we found some inconsistency with that in this draft and the treatment of a right of return, for example, where in the right of return, the way the exposure draft proposes to treat it is as if it were a failed sale, and so revenue isn't recognised for the expected return. And I'm not sure I can see the difference between that and a customer having a put option back to me. So to us, there's some inconsistencies in how the control model would apply in that situation, but also that's an example of where we think a risk and reward model would have worked better, would have given an answer that we would have been more comfortable with. And maybe it's going back to your point before that it's what we're used to, it's what we're more comfortable with. We're not comfortable recognising revenue in a situation where the customer can put the thing back to me tomorrow. So that's part of the concern around it. On the continuous transfer, I'm not sure if you want to come back to that later and we can perhaps discuss it then, but on the continuous transfer of control, our view is that we can see why the board got there. We can see what you were trying to do in coming up with that notion, having sat on the IFRIC when we went through the whole process of the sales of apartment, off the plan sales. I remember clearly at the end of the IFRIC discussion that we thought that we didn't think there'd be any circumstance where continuous transfer would be met in those sorts of off the plan sales. And we're worried now that it having been introduced into the standard, that there's going to be confusion in practice as to when the continuous transfer is and isn't met. And we think the standard needs more clarity, perhaps more examples, more application guidance, to Nicholas's point. And as we've said in our comment letter, we actually think that continuous transfer is sort of an exception to the control model. It's a way that perhaps the way that you've stretched the model to get percentage of completion in. And so while we support it, we think you might need to justify it differently.
Would any return right delay the recognition of revenue, or is it in certain situations, or?
Well, what we're saying is it's a concern because it's a different model. Under the old model, you wouldn't recognise revenue because you'd say the risk and rewards haven't been passed to somebody else, so I wouldn't recognise the sale. Under this model, under the control model, you would, because you'd say, well, the customer controls the asset, it can presumably freely deal with it, but one of the ways it can freely deal with it is put it back to me.
Barry?
So I raised this this morning, I'm going to raise it again. Excuse me. In Norwalk last week, one of the participants encouraged us to develop more application guidance around a control model, but said, look, at the end of the day, if you can't get there, you know, we'd be just fine if you had two models, because there are people that are having difficulty reconciling a control model to a continuous transfer notion under service contracts or long-term construction contracts. This morning's participants, in response to that, maybe not unanimously, but pretty close to it, said that they really support the fact that, or the notion that the board should develop one model. One participant said, well, when it comes to continuous transfer of services, et cetera, that the board could have a rebuttable presumption that control transfers over time, which to me is kind of saying we have two models but not admitting to it. And I guess, you know, Ruth, you just said that you believe it's an exception. And I'm just curious as to other people's reaction, because I think what we ought to do is articulate what we mean. And if there's confusion surrounding a specific control-based notion and the difficulty of applying that to certain fact patterns, and that fact pattern seems to be the provision of services or construction of long-term contracts, you know, that occur over a long period of time, then why don't we just, you know, develop models along those lines and put parameters as to when you get in one versus the other? And I'm just curious as to other people's reactions.
And I would say this is a central question for us when we look at the EZ. We did debate internally whether we supported a control model versus a risks and rewards model, and one reason that we came out in our letter in favour of the control model was that we were conscious that currently there's a mixed model, risks and rewards for some transactions, activity-based for other types of transactions under current IFRSs. And it seemed to us that the attempt to stretch the risks and rewards model in IFRIC 15 had been quite problematic in practice. So we support control. We would support having a single principle if that principle can be shown to be clear and operational. I think I share some of the concerns that I can see perhaps more than one thing happening in the EZ. If I read the definition of control, very, very focused on present rights and present access to benefits within, I think it's paragraph 26 and 27, and that seems something that I understand, that seems quite strict and quite tough, and perhaps would make it quite difficult to get to what some people would think was the natural accounting outcome, some kind of percentage of completion in some cases. Conversely, when I look at the indicators, they seem rather more permissive. There seems to be a lot in the indicators that would make it easier to get to some kind of continuous transfer. So I would like there to be a single principle. I think that would be an absolutely fantastic achievement and is a goal worth aiming for. But I think achieving that would require wrapping together the concept and indicators of control more closely. We talk in our letter about what would happen if that couldn't be done, and I think we come out and say that we'd rather have a clear exception than an unclear principle. But I think we would prefer, above all, a clear principle. But I think there's a bit more work to be done to get that.
Francois Floret, IFRAC. Well, to address the various issues that have already been covered, I would say that IFRAC has taken the view that indeed, if it was possible to design one single model for revenue recognition, some improvement would be made. I think we have in mind that if that's possible, it is because the model would provide relevant revenue information for all industries without any exception. We don't think, obviously from what you tell us, I mean, the comment letters reflect that, and that industries do have issues with the possible implementation of the control model as suggested by the proposal. Although, in designing the indicators, the ED has already tried to accommodate the transfer of control notion to a variety of situations. Nevertheless, it has proven not to be enough. And so we have looked into why we believe that the transfer of control didn't work. And I think we have, you know, the proposal at present say, well, there needs to be a contract to recognize revenue, and that we certainly agree with. But it doesn't say anything else about the contract. And the reality is that the obligations of a customer in a contract vary deeply from one industry to the other. And the level of commitment of the customer in the contract usually reflects the ability of the supplier to service service another customer with the same product or with the same accomplishment to date. So if I try to illustrate, if I order a car, an ordinary car, one that anybody can buy, I will sign a contract, and that contract will say that in case I don't want to take possession of the car, I have a penalty, which is a down payment that I have to relinquish. If I want a specific piece of equipment to be designed and manufactured just for my own benefits, then probably the supplier is going to ask me to be committed from the first day to compensate for any work done. And that will be in the contract or in the legal framework. I mean, not everything is within contract, but the obligation of the customer would be there. And that's the other issue that we have considered, is that revenue should be more seen as being in the perspective of the reporting entity rather than from the customer's perspective, because it's the story of the entity that the accounts are telling. And so we have tried to concentrate, in fact, on in how the entity was acquiring rights to consideration. Because any entity will enter in contract with customers for an exchange of a good or a service for compensation, for consideration. And so we have concentrated on how the entity was acquiring its right to consideration. And we're not a standard setter, don't wish to be one, so we cannot go any further than what we've done in our comment letter. But we have tried to formulate a principle on that basis, and we believe that it would fit the various industries and meet the concerns expressed by a variety of people. Sorry for being very long.
Henry?
I just wanted to ask a question, really, and it's more to Ruth and to Brian's point. And Ruth, you were mentioning in your letter, you talk about an exception to the principle, but I just wanted to clarify, really, is it the word control, or is it actually our principle of transfer of goods and services to the customer that's the problem? So I guess my question is, do you think in the typical IS 11 construction type contract there is a sort of continuous transfer of services, of benefits, of value from the entity to its customer? And if so, that would suggest that perhaps the problem is if the word control gets in the way, because it forces you to think about that perhaps the completed asset at the end of the contract. And so I just wanted to say, or do you think that there isn't actually any transfer of value going on during the contract?
It's the latter. It's the word control that's getting in the way and causing problems. And I think you've tried to clarify it by saying somewhere that it's control of the asset in its partly completed state that you need to focus on. But I think it is the word control that's getting in the way. I don't think there's just agreement that something's happening, something's being transferred, something of value is being transferred. And the customer's paying for it, so the customer must recognise that something's happening. But it's what is it that's being transferred, and is it control that's being transferred, which is what we're struggling with.
So that we could still keep that overarching idea of the transfer from the entity to its customer, but what we have to do is to improve the articulation of when that's actually occurring.
and how it fits with control.
Yeah. I think you asked the questions about this. I would agree with that. Control is used in lots of places. The word control feels like a stumbling block. If you want to do anything other than recognise revenue, once you hand over the complete asset in our letter, we use the phrase effective control, or like the idea that there might be something like a concept of effective control, which may even be what you had in mind when you were developing the interfaces.
Yeah. I'm Ramana from Zeven Stroke Management. The revenue is the money paid by the buyer to the seller. But the exposure draft, I find there's a gap. If you see, if the money is not paid by the buyer, but the money comes from somebody else. For example, mini consultancy company with which we work, the money is paid by a third party, let's say a big international funding agent, but the services are used by several other customers. So in that case, the control from the consultant provider to the consultant user and the money payment, the link is not very explicitly given. So exposure draft, I feel there is a gap in addressing this type of contracts where there is no money transaction between the buyer and seller, but the money paid by a third party. In that situation, how to use this exposure draft? For example, a big consultancy firm provides several services to various public enterprises in India, but the money paid by a large international funding agent. So where is this revenue? The revenue with the control link is not very clearly visible there. So I thought maybe some thought can be given to that.
But it's mostly a wording matter?
Not only wording, but also the spirit of the transaction. To be more explicit, let's say that I'm a consultancy firm. We are into big consulting. But the money that we get is from a funding agent. But our contract is that we provide services to half a dozen clients. So where is this control? I get my money from one party. My services are given, are enjoyed by some other party. So I'm not able to very clearly pinpoint how is the control can be implemented there. That's what I also mentioned there in my...
Dr. Ramana, does the funder release the funds on the basis of what services you've transferred to the to the agencies?
Yeah.
So there is that link in that the funder is releasing the money to reflect the transfer to the customer.
Okay, so therefore for me, as per this, it's the funder is a customer, not the user of my services.
I just wonder if it's the recipient of the consultancy, the transferee of the services, who would perhaps be the customer, and the funder is just a beneficent body. But it is an interesting point, and not one.
Perhaps you want a clarification.
Perhaps you're in the awkward situation that it's not a contract with the customer; it's a customer without the contract.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Finn?
Yes, Saul Varden from the Institute. Just to say, we do support, providing it's properly developed, we do support the control model. I actually don't think IS 18 is a pure risk and rewards model at the moment. The treatment of retailer sales with a right of return is not a pure risks and rewards model even right now. To be very specific about one of the difficulties around control, and it is partly the word, but it's also that if you look to paragraph 26 of the ED, that points out that control includes the ability to prevent others from benefiting from an item. Now, if you think about work in progress, you actually have a spectrum for a part complete item. At one extreme, you have something that even if the seller ceased to exist, that part complete work would be useful to the customer because they could take it away and actually get someone else to finish it. At the other extreme, that's not the case at all, but what is clear is that that part complete work could never have value to anyone else. Its value can only be for this particular customer. Now, this principle in paragraph 26 might suggest that even that is enough for there to be control by the customer, and personally I can see that argument. But I think a lot of the confusion stems from this quite wide range of possible ways of thinking about the control concept. You know, is it lack of usefulness to others or genuine usefulness to this particular customer. That covers quite a wide spectrum and is extremely relevant, for example, for lots of professional services and other things too.
Thank you. Andrew Buchanan, BDO. I would join the others in saying that if it can be appropriate to refine the control model as the one that we would support. In common with others, the issue that we see is on continuous transfer. Probably, again, as others have said, that because the use of the word control tends to imply that there needs to be a transfer of something that's completed, and that rather gets in the way. Ways in which it might be looked at a little bit more broadly might be to consider looking at what the customer is actually getting, even if there isn't physical possession at a particular point. And that might be something where something is being built for the customer, say it's something like a new oil tanker that takes a few years to build that, it's sitting in the shipyard, the customer is not going to get near it, but something is happening as that ship's being constructed, even though it's a pretty standard design, it's not bespoke. So if you look at what the customer is getting, you could even argue that because a customer is halfway through 1.5 years from getting the boat rather than 3 years, the customer is getting something as it goes along, because there is that benefit of being closer to delivery. So that then takes you into the notion of, as others have said, question of effective control, possibly a question of effective delivery. There is the point that is already in the definition of an unconditional obligation to pay. There is the question of, is there an unconditional obligation to pay for what's been done so far, even if all you're going to get is something that's deliverable at the end and not before. That would then take you into something like a design agency that's doing a new logo for a company. The logo gets delivered at the end, but there's an awful lot of work being done specifically for that customer as you go along. Closer to home, the audit service is one where if the audit stops halfway through, as Phil said, there's absolutely no benefit because someone else has got to start again. But there's benefit being transferred because the audit work is being done over that period. So it might be worth just broadening it a little bit, not moving away completely from the use of control, but looking at how control works in the context of these particular contracts.
Ethel Knoll, German Accounting Standards Board. Just a few very brief remarks. We haven't really gone into the four indicators at length. We've been sort of round and round, some more than others. And I guess it's B and C, which we might stumble over the legal title, sounds so very sort of final, and there it seems to be difficult to see something progressing, and even the physical possession is something where maybe it only happens in the end. So to phrase it the other way around, we would be very much in favour of having the possibility of a sort of POC outcome. And we probably are a little more hung up around about the word control and these indicators here. On the other hand, possibly from my background of my current work, because of IS 18, there has been a lot of industry-specific usage somehow. And a lot of problems arise now that people look for specific guidance. And the ISB and the FASB trying to get higher up to a principle, you haven't really got different industries all on board yet, and you probably or hopefully don't want to produce all the guidance that's out there now, but you have to somehow bring people on board, and all those who cannot see their guidance yet under the new standard could hopefully be brought on board without you producing the standard like that, but we've got an uphill, maybe, educational effort there.
Francois, then Frederick, and then we close this topic.
Okay. So Francois Flores and IFRAC, I would like to follow up on what has been said about the rights in the contract and what the customer gets. I know the ISB is not necessarily oversensitive to the behaviors that a particular standard can direct or suggest, but I think it would be very unfortunate if, in order to get to a relevant revenue recognition, entities were encouraged to, in the contract, provide more and more rights to their customers. So I don't think it would necessarily be a good accomplishment. I also questioning why necessarily revenue would only accrue when what the entity is building up as per the contract needs to be the asset of the customer at any point in time before it is delivered. And I'm afraid that wanting to go down this route is maybe a good way of distorting somewhere the control notion if this remains being called control. Then I would like just to focus a minute on the indicators because some people have in the discussion told us, but you know, the obligation to pay it, is one of the indicators that has been proposed to depict the transfer that is occurring. But it is done in a way that nothing other than the passage of time is a limitation to the entity getting the consideration in the end. And in fact, contracts are made, I mean, those contracts in which the customer indeed accepts to be committed to that obligation to pay, they have, they include protective rights to the customer because the customer is obliged to pay subject to the entity completing what has been promised under the contract. So there is always a subject to performance, subject to continued performance clause there. And I would analyze that more as a protective right than anything else. So even if we had to rely on this indicator to get the right answer, I think the indicator should be designed in a different fashion.
Just a couple of remarks really quickly. I mean, just to go back to the indicators, I just wanted to stress the point that the two indicators that were mentioned, physical possession and legal title, could very well have very little substance, intangible assets. For instance, we could very well develop software for someone, and that development could be very specific to the customer, and we could easily arrange to deliver the code and complete every night and structure the contract in a manner where, you know, title passes every night on the then developed code. And in our view, this would have very, this would be counterintuitive to the objectives of the standard. That was the first remark. The other thing is that there's something called continuous transfer that I think we use today in practice, and it's this notion of when we're performing a number of different acts for a customer, sometimes one of these acts is more significant to all of the others. If I go back to the audit services example, I mean, in my view, the delivery of the audit report is the final act and has a lot more significance than anything else that was performed before. I was just wondering whether that could be, you know, one of the indicators of continuous transfer or not continuous transfer that could be, maybe could clarify things and how consistent this would be with the model.
Well, thank you for that. Let's turn to separate performance obligations, April.
Yeah, the second topic, which was of interest to a number of people, was identifying the separate performance obligations. Now, the ED proposes that the entity would identify the separate performance obligations on the basis of whether the promised good or service was distinct. And there is guidance given in the proposed standard as to how you would tell if a good or service is distinct. Some of the discussion points which were suggested and some of the comments coming out of the comment letters are how the identification of individual performance obligation links with the segmentation proposals that we outline at step one. Also, what sort of level of guidance is going to be needed for people to come to a consistent recognition of what is a distinct good or service. But this area generally particularly affects long-term contracts, construction contracts, and some people in that sector feel that performance obligations could be identified based on things like operational interdependencies. So there's, if we could begin with a general discussion of how you identify performance obligations, how you know if they're distinct and if that's helpful. There are a couple of particular types of performance obligations, warranties and licenses, which I think some of you would like to discuss after that. So any general points on identifying performance obligations, is the guidance on distinct helpful? I don't know, Nico, if you'd like to start from the structure's point of view.
Well, for us, the example, I think it's example 11, was very helpful, which explains that if you have an contract management service that provides an umbrella to the overall elements within the contract, that this creates the umbrella and that defines the unit of account, the performance obligation, basically. For us, it would be helpful to stress that in a final standard and possibly even take it into the main body, because we have discussed that this example with several people, and some people might look at it differently. Some people say, well, there are architect engineers out there that provide contract management services, so that might be a distinct separate performance obligation, which results in you having a lot of performance obligations with a construction type contract. So we would welcome if you explicitly include that into the final standard, and you could possibly even say, well, if the contract management service creates is a significant element within the overall contract and really provides for the glue for the overall performance obligations, or sorry, not performance obligations, but elements, then that creates the umbrella and hence determines the performance obligations.
Phil Barden Institute. I guess this is an area that's new, because we don't have any meaningful guidance in existing IFRSs on this subject. We do have guidance elsewhere. So in particular in the UK, we have some guidance in FRS 5, which is written somewhat differently. It does seem to me that this issue is of greater significance where the items that might be distinct are what you might think of as goods, i.e. point in time transfer of control rather than continuous transfer of control. For continuous transfer of control, this mainly affects the proportion of revenue that you're recognising for each stage, but it doesn't dramatically alter the overall profile of revenue recognition, whereas it does dramatically alter that profile if you're talking about goods or point in time transfer. It seems to me that the approach that's in paragraph 23, with one exception, seems to overlap pretty well with what we have in UK GAAP, and what we have in UK GAAP seems to work okay in practice. The exception is the reference in paragraph B2 to the distinct margin, which we find pretty unclear and possibly unnecessary. It's unclear in the sense that since you're required to estimate all sorts of other things in this standard, on the face of it, you'd always be able to estimate a margin if it was a theoretical question. If it's a very practical question, potentially lots of things that we would have thought of as naturally distinct might not be, and it's quite grey as to where you might draw the line on those. So our starting position was to be reasonably happy with paragraph 23 except for the bit on margin. Now, one of the consequences of that might be that for continuous transfer contracts, in theory, you could end up unbundling a great deal. You might find very many distinct elements. I'm not sure that that is necessarily a failing of the model, and I'm not sure that it is necessarily more than a mainly practical question, because if you can keep drilling down and keep drilling down, if actually the impact of doing that is not all that significant, then you'd want to stop. So another solution to that might be simply to make clear to people, don't go very far, only worry about elements that might have quite different margins, because that's the only real impact of unbundling.
Also, so that's IFRAC. Well, we are supportive of what the proposals say in that area. The only caveat that we have indicated has to do with the notion of distinct goods and services, that in our view it should be assessed from the own customary practice of the entity. And if that was done, I think Nicholas' concern about the management service, including the contract, being appreciated related to the practice of a complete different entity that provides only this kind of services would be avoided.
I think we agree with the view that the distinct margin is probably creating more issues for us than helping in the analysis, notably because we generally sell our licenses together, packaged with them, a year of maintenance. It is our business model to separate this. We view this separate. We may have difficulties demonstrating that we have a distinct margin, but if certain constituents tend to think like this, and we have a concern with it.
Just a slight warning or peeking ahead. I know peeking ahead is normally not allowed, but if and when we now separate performance obligations here, we set the stone for what's to come under the owner's performance obligation, because some people would probably agree here to separate things, but not necessarily agree on the level for seeing something as onerous, and therefore it's fine to say here, yes, we agree, but then come round later and say, no, thank you, we want to go up again.
If you don't peek ahead, you will put your foot in the wrong place.
Swedish proverb.
Bruce Picker. I just wanted to say that we support the notion of performance obligations and think that is a very useful principle under the revenue recognition model. Agree with the concerns about profit margin and agree with the peeking ahead about onerous contracts. I would echo all of those.
Can I just ask a question to Phil? Because I think you're basically saying that once you've got a continuous delivery contract, then this becomes less of a critical issue. And I think you're suggesting, well, if you start with a sort of like a top-down approach and drill down, then it's perhaps less problematic when you have got like a construction contract. I guess my question would be is, would you put any constraint on how far you could go? Because I guess in construction contract accounting today, you start with the presumption that the contract is the unit of account, and then you can only go and start revealing different margins if you've got very strong evidence for those margins. So what would you suggest in terms of sort of, because you sort of implied that, well, you just let people go to the extent that there's something materially different to reveal, but would you put any constraint on it?
I think that as IAS 11 is written, it's not quite as clear-cut that you could never have different stages. I think there are some words in there. Some of the methodologies that you might use might actually allocate slightly different margins to different stages. But I do see this is a second-order question. I'm not suggesting it's unimportant, just that the impact on revenue is less dramatic than the first-order question. And no, I don't think I would put any particular constraints on it. It does seem to me that it's in the nature of most continuous transfer contracts, but actually it's all incremental. Every single bit could be a separate thing. If you're thinking about constructing a building, putting one brick on is something that somebody can do. Now, it would be madness to go there, but theoretically it's true. So it's mainly a practical question for me as to how far down you want to go before it stops being worth going any further.
So how far would you go?
Were
it custom to do something?
Far enough to be satisfied that if I went any further, I would not be improving the quality of financial information.
I guess, yeah, so you're basically saying that you disaggregate to the extent that it does reveal information about different timing or different margin, and if it doesn't, then you don't do it.
I think it matters a great deal depending on what has been combined in a contract. There are some contracts that will combine elements that you might expect have very markedly different margins, and you do sell those elements separately, and you can see they're very different. You know, there's perhaps a very, very skillful element, and quite a basic element, and the margin on the very skillful element is much higher. There are other contracts where that's not particularly true. There is no external evidence to suggest that there are markedly different margins for different stages, and if I see no such external evidence, I don't particularly want to go looking for it.
So if you never had the practice of selling different aspects of a particular contract or different phases of a particular contract, if you never sold them separately, you would then not drill down to those separate phases? One of the concerns raised in Norwalk by some of the participants, particularly in the construction industry, was that the ED effectively allows you to do whatever you want to do. It gives you a blank check in terms of how to parcel your contract, and you can either do it very broadly, because you have this overview of contract management services, or you can go down to the individual nail if you wanted to. So, but if you, as a seller of this building or construction contract, never went down to a lower level, you always deliver completed buildings or what have you, would you drill down to a lower level?
Let me maybe try to answer that with an example. Some construction contracts may involve both a design phase and a construction phase. It's entirely possible that the people doing the design work are quite different from the people doing the construction work. I don't think it's only important to consider what a particular entity does. There may well be a market for design services quite separate from construction services. There may be a separate market for construction services. It may be relatively clear what sort of margins typically prevail for each of those if they are bought separately in the market. If they are very markedly different, I might want to think about those separately. If actually I can't even see that sort of information because the reality is people just don't buy these individual phases separately, then I've no particular reason to want to start splitting this contract because I'm going to be estimating the selling prices anyway. And I don't have anything particularly great to use as the basis for that estimation. So it becomes unnecessarily sophisticated and no more reliable really than not splitting the contract. So I guess I would probably express it as, if I can see some positive indicators that I ought to break the contract down because I actually see a positive reason to think that the margins on this stage should be different from the margins on this stage, I would break it down. Absent that, I wouldn't. But this is only for pure percentage of completion. I'm not suggesting that this applies more widely.
Brian, last comment on this topic?
Yep, and it's probably a response to Henry's question, perhaps picking up on the contract management services point, because I do think that construction contracts will be a key area of focus when identifying distinct performance obligations, as you were implying, and I wonder if slightly more developed guidance around the contract management services example would help. We found it came up again and again whenever we were discussing contract construction contract accounting. I can imagine there would be an awful lot of interpretive weight placed on that particular example, and it would be helpful to have perhaps more than one example that illustrates the two different possible scenarios and would help mitigate the concern that would be a complete free-for-all, because at least there would be an agreed starting point where you would have some contracts that were clearly pulled together because of the construction and management service and other contracts where there was a presumption that you'd have to start examining things in a lot more detail. For the record, at the general level, I would echo the comments about supporting distinct motion generally, but don't feel that it's necessary to have the distinct.
There are two particular types of performance obligations, just rather quickly, that were covered in the application guidance in the proposed standard, and which I think are of interest to people in this room, and that's product warranties and licenses. So if we could just briefly see if we have any particular views in the room. Product warranties, for example, if we just start with that, the board's proposed that there are two different types, as you may remember, one quality, one insurance. The second is a performance obligation, where it's a separate service revenue recognized attributed to that. The first one it represents the fact that some of the original goods which were delivered didn't satisfactorily satisfy those performance obligations, and so revenue is deferred until those obligations are satisfied. Now, I know a couple of you raised this point. I don't know if anyone wants to talk about product warranties in this forum. Stevens mentioned it, or Lisa, or shall we move on?
I think we possibly share the concern that many have that it's very difficult to really differentiate between latent defects and other warranties. And I mean, for us, possibly an approach that can be applied rather easily than this one would possibly say to say what is the standard warranty that you would grant to that product in that specific jurisdiction, and say that everything that is extra that would be separate off. Or you could have another way to look at it and basically say if there's a possibility for the customer to go for that extra and to have that option to buy that additional warranty, then that creates a separate unit of account somehow. The other distinction, which is currently in the exposure draft, seems to be rather difficult to apply, and that is something that we also got as feedback from our people involved within Siemens when we asked them how to apply that.
It seemed to us that the accounting proposed by the ED was probably fine, but that the way that it was justified seemed not to stack up, and it's around inherent defects. If you supply a washing machine with a broken drive belt, it seems from the ED that you treat replacing the drive belt as though it was a separate performance obligation, even though you haven't actually called it one in the ED. That seems perfectly sensible to us. It's just confusing that the ED tells you it's not a performance obligation and then you go and account for it as though it is.
Licenses. I know Dassault perhaps are interested in licenses.
Yes, indeed we are. Frédéric Duneau from ESAG. Basically, first of all, I think we are supportive of the model that is proposed, distinguishing between exclusive licenses and non-exclusive licenses. We are in the business, software companies are in the business of basically selling the right to use an intangible asset. But this being said, I mean, we do consider that we are selling products, and this is also the case of music companies. And I think it is very important for our industry to get a robust model that can easily help us distinguishing between, whenever we sold a product from we are actually leasing an intangible asset. We believe that what's suggested works in our case. We feel a little, when we read the comment letters, we felt a little bit isolated, I guess. The point is, we need something. And it's quite intuitive, I think, when we purchase a CD of music, that we're buying a product. This would address the matter. If this is no longer in the final standard, we would need something else. And frankly speaking, I mean, when we thought about it, this was the best idea we could think of. We couldn't come up with a better idea on this one.
The next area which is of interest to people, you have to obviously, in applying the proposed standard, determine what your transaction price is. And the proposal is that the transaction price would reflect the probability weighted amount of consideration that the entity expects to receive from the customer. This raised a number of topics and comment letters. Some people discussed the significance of that and the helpfulness of using probability weighted transaction prices compared with the most likely or expected outcome over a variety of different types of transactions. The standard also requires that the effect of customers' credit risk and the time value of money should be reflected in the measurement of revenue. And so for these factors, any points you'd like to put to the board members? I know KPMG had an interesting point.
Thank you very much. two important points which have a huge ramification here is a credit risk. The other is a time value of money, which you have mentioned. Now, for example, particularly in a utility company, when we are selling, for example, the utility for which we work as a consultant, they sell to 1.5 to 2 million customers. The credit risk, if you start linking the price with the credit risk of this customer, then it's not possible to fix a price there. Because the customers are a wide range of the credit risk is there. And moreover, in this case, there is a regulated price. So therefore, one is, if there is a customer profile is so large and so wide, how are you going to bring in the credit risk in fixing the price? So either there has to be a dealing between the credit risk and the price, or there has to be some intermediary way, which at least we are not able to think about it. The second one, if permitted, I can say, is the time value of money, which you said that wherever necessary, there's a need to bring in the time value of money. Suppose two companies are doing the same business. One is financed with the equity, the other is financed with the debt and equity. So the time value of money clarity is not there. What should be the discounted rate? Is it be the KD or the WACC or KE? Or should we leave it to the company? If we leave it to the company, then there is a possibility of difficulty in the interpretation from the user point of view. So these are the immediate points which I thought I'll share.
I find this a difficult area because I don't feel comfortable with the answer we've got to, but I don't have a solution to it. But maybe if I can outline why I don't feel comfortable. The weighted average approach, there seem to be quite a few circumstances in which that will give answers that seem okay. There also seem to be some circumstances where I'm concerned about it. If I can pick two such examples, one would be where you are providing a service to someone and you will be paid for that service, but you will also receive a what we might think of as a contingent success fee, and success is not within your control. So a classic thing might be that you're helping someone towards a listing, and the listing may or may not happen. In those circumstances at the moment, I think we would tend to think of that success fee as being something that you don't bring in until you get pretty confident that it's going to happen. Whereas under this approach, you might exclude it on the basis that you can't reliably estimate it, and so you might get to the same place. On the other hand, there may be other examples where actually you can reliably estimate it, even though there is only a 70% chance of it happening. So I'm nervous about those kind of binary outcomes bringing in something quite a bit sooner than we might at the moment. But I don't have a particular solution to that. The one that worries me slightly more, and perhaps I just misunderstand the ED, is that construction contracts may specify a transaction price, but the reality of them very often is that there is no single transaction price. There is a sort of starting point with adjustments, and those adjustments may include additional revenue for delivering early and penalties for delivering late. And there's actually no difference between writing a contract that says the core price is 100 for delivery at the end of August, with something extra if you deliver early and less if you deliver late, or writing the same contract to have the delivery date a week earlier with a higher amount payable and the same adjustments. Economically, they're exactly the same. Now, I don't know that I can put a probability on each of the possible outcomes there. And I'm not really sure how I apply the ED in those circumstances. Whereas at the moment, I probably would look at the range of likely outcomes and be keen to choose something at the more prudent end of that range. So I'm not totally sure I know how the ED even works in those circumstances.
Sorry, which end did you say? I missed. Choose something at what end?
Well, if
prudent end, was it?
Yeah, the prudent end. So if I thought delivery might be between...
I heard that word in the last session too.
I'll try not to use it again. But,
try not.
But if I thought delivery might be between the last week of July and the middle of August, I might base the calculations more on towards the middle of August than the last week of July, is all I'm saying.
Okay.
The contingent revenue, and you touch the two transactions. One is legal, and another one is the service typically by the security dealers. And there are three alternatives, and one is, you know, as you say, it's some kind of reliable basis. Another one is to estimate the total amount to allocate straight line based on time passing. And finally, I think I remember the board once discussed, and some of board members mentioned, whether there are two separate performance obligations. One is based on the timing, and another one is based on the final outcome. Have you ever think about the final one?
I can see you might say it that way. I personally would much rather see a performance obligation as something that the seller does or could fail to do. So I don't really like to think of something that's got nothing to do with the seller as being a performance obligation. It doesn't seem a very natural way of using the words. So I prefer not to try to do it that way.
Briefly, it got us debating examples and examples and struggling with the debits and credits. Specifically, maybe this may be an area where the proposal seems to be very sophisticated and we haven't found the right end yet of all the mess transactions where we've never been so sophisticated about and where maybe it isn't really necessary to do it that way. I mean, the time value of money, most receivables would be not necessarily going over 12 months, so a lot of that would go out of the way, but then people haven't really been used to thinking of using discounting. And the other one is the one with the credit risk. That was the one where we said, well, if I book my invoice, even most systems would systematically have the invoice amount going to revenue. Of course, you can change systems, that's not the problem. But if you have sort of an invoice amount and that doesn't end up as revenue, that's where we struggle where to put the debits and credits. And maybe, again, it's an area where we need some more help, not necessarily in lots of books or whatever, but maybe just a little more imagination what this all entails.
Brian?
April almost cued me in, saying that KPMG had made an interesting point, and I'm tempted to ask which of our points was the interesting one.
They were all fascinating.
Thank you very much. I wanted to comment specifically on credit risk, because that's something that we spent quite a long time discussing, and it was one of those topics where the way we asked the question seemed to determine the answer. Whenever we asked people whether or not revenue should be adjusted for credit risk, the most people in the room kind of tensed up and felt that they were being asked to do something really quite onerous and quite difficult. On the other hand, if we said to people, do you believe that you should book as revenue an amount that you never expect to collect, everybody said, well, of course we shouldn't. And where we got to in our discussions on credit risk was it seemed sensible for us to be there to be some kind of recognition threshold where people were certainly not booking as revenue amounts they have no expectation of receiving. I take the point that the systems that the debits put the credit somewhere, but a recognition threshold seemed to us to be important. And then perhaps a practical way of dealing with the case where you have a very large number of similar transactions where it's very, very difficult to assess on an individual basis, perhaps above the recognition threshold, we should be looking at a most likely amount. There are some cases where your normal expectation is that you will bill and collect. There will be other cases where your billing is almost part of your negotiation, part of your strategy, and that felt different. So we spent a lot of time on credit risk, but where we got to was the recognition thresholds and perhaps most likely amount of the recognition thresholds being a more practical approach than probability weights.
Couple of comments, firstly on the contingent consideration and then on the credit risk. We had a similar concern about contingent consideration where the consideration is not within my control, the supplier's control, and recognising something that may or may not happen and there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. It's
something that the customer does or something that happens externally. So we were quite worried about making an estimate of that and including that in revenue. But I won't use the bad word that's related to that. But from a conceptual point of view, the struggle that I had with it was, I'm not sure whether the board was looking at a recognition criterion or measurement criterion when you're looking at probability weighted averages. And in that binary outcome that Phil referred to earlier, if there's a 30% possibility that either you'll get a fixed fee or you'll get nothing, is that 30% too low in the first place as a recognition threshold for me to recognise anything at all? Or do I still take it into account because it's part of my probability weighted average in the measurement test? And that's where we got quite concerned. We weren't clear what you were thinking, really. And we think it needs a bit of a rethink, particularly where the consideration is outside the entity's control. And perhaps there's another way to approach it. It might be a best estimate approach. Perhaps you need to give some guidance about where recognition ends and measurement begins, because we found it difficult to find in here. On the credit risk, customers' credit risk, we had difficulty with the initial amount being removed from the measurement of revenue, but subsequent adjustments being taken into other income. And we thought you might want to field test that with people as to how that will go down in practice.
Sorry, last comment on this.
Okay, thank you. Andrew Buchanan, BDO. I'll just touch briefly on contingent revenue. I think that the concerns we have been articulated quite clearly by others. It's the binary amount. It's how certain are you to get anything anyway? And we certainly had similar discussions on should there be some sort of recognition threshold. When do you actually get something that you can recognise? Two things though, that I did want just to touch on are the credit risk and the time value, start time value. We're reasonably comfortable at the concept of including time value in both directions. Perhaps for me it's not quite so difficult because I come from a jurisdiction where we've been doing that for a few years anyway, so it feels quite natural to me. And I can try and persuade my colleagues that it's a natural thing to do as well. The one where perhaps there are a number of issues in the background is the customer credit risk, because again, when there's a discussion, there's a degree of comfort that one ought to recognise what you think you're going to get. And if you think you're not going to get everything, then you get the discomfort of recognising all of the amount. Where you get, though, is that let's say you've got a company which has a very, very wide range of customers and a very large number of transactions, and a lot of these are settled within an accounting period, even if that's a quarter. If we look at the way the guidance would work, you would record your estimated amount in revenue and then true up somewhere else in the income statement. And that might bring some quite significant systems issues for a lot of companies. Now, the solution that you then get to is, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to put the true up within the revenue line? That might be something to explore. You then get the other side of it, of where do you put bad debt expense? And we didn't quite get to the question of could you justify putting bad debt expense in revenue as well. But if you were being consistent, I think that's where you would end up.
April?
Okay. The next topic, which is arisen, is based on allocation. The ED proposes that you would allocate the transaction price to all of the separate performance obligations identified in proportion to the standalone selling price of those goods or services underlying each performance obligation. And there are a couple of sort of discussion points which have come out of the comment letters. There's a concern in some areas that where you don't actually sell anything on a standalone basis, how readily could you estimate that standalone selling price? There's a link between the allocation of the revenue to the standalone selling price, how that interrelates with the segmentation proposals, and how you would allocate any discounts or variable consideration for those segments. there was some suggestion in some comment letters that there might be alternatives that could be applied in some instances to a standalone selling price. So does anyone want to say anything?
As you know, I've made this point many times, so we've had this discussion before. Starting from standalone selling price seems like the right starting point. The question of where, how you allocate discounts against that, I think, is much more difficult. And any methodology that you mandate will not inherently reflect economics. It will just be a methodology that you mandate. The one that is set out in the ED will often give answers that are perfectly okay. I think it's quite straightforward to construct examples in which it gives answers that in no way reflect the underlying economics. All of those examples will start from a mixture of something with a very high margin and some other things with very low margins, and a discount is clearly being given on the high margin item, and it's not hard to come up with examples of those. So for us, the question is, do you mandate a single approach to allocating discounts, or do you mandate such an approach but allow exceptions to it, or do you actually allow freedom over how to allocate discounts, or do you specify a choice of approaches and ask people to choose the one that actually best reflects their particular circumstances? Now, I think there may be different views on this, not least depending on where you come from. Certainly not in the Institute discussions, but in our Deloitte discussions, we found that those coming from a US background were much keener on having something relatively prescriptive, and those coming from a non-US background were more relaxed about having relative freedom. And I don't think there's a single right answer to this. But I do think that mandating one approach in all circumstances just gives demonstrably bad answers sometimes. So there needs to be a departure from that. It's just a question of how far. And if you were to move to other approaches, one of them might be based around allocating relative to margins rather than selling prices. That will at least not result in things being depicted as loss-making that are actually entirely profitable. Another approach might be a residual approach. A third factor to bear in mind here is practicality. Although the approach that is based entirely on standalone selling price has the advantage of being entirely objective, as soon as you revise any of your estimates, you have to revise your allocation to everything. So life is relatively complicated, whereas a residual approach is actually relatively straightforward to apply. And if you're looking at a very high volume of transactions, all of which are relatively small, from a systems point of view, a residual approach is going to be far, far easier to do. I can see arguments for it.
Frédéric Duneau from ESAG. We are concerned as well in the software industry about the ability to use residual methods. But that goes beyond just the practical matters. We do face the same practical matters that you mentioned, but I think our concerns go way beyond this. We truly believe that we will have almost an impossibility to determine the estimated selling prices for our licenses. And the reason for this is that we never sell them separately. These products are not really comparable to the products of other people. That wouldn't make sense. And software doesn't really have incremental cost to it. Once you've developed it, there's no incremental cost. So a cost plus margin approach wouldn't be relevant either. So it leaves us with residual method, which is what we use today. And absent the ability to use this, we truly don't know how we would do it. And reading the paragraph 125 in the basis for conclusions, we are unclear as to what the intention is. This paragraph basically makes a reference to the fact that the residual method could be a starting point in the estimation. We don't know how to read this, and we believe that we would gain from more clarity on this one. Also, maybe just as an additional point, I mean, further complicating the matter, since we don't really have an incremental cost to ourselves, our pricing is not really consistent. So the estimation of the selling price is very difficult. Like, pricing could vary considerably, and discounts could vary considerably.
Not that much to add, other than probably do we fear freedom in this area, or could we live with freedom? And it is not just sort of the geographical or gap background, it's the industry background too. And it's the industry background too where there is a very strong noise that the standalone selling price just doesn't work. And the residual method has worked, presumably, and if we have different industry backgrounds, is this really an area we need to clarify? Because if we then come up with three different methods, it's going to be very diversified anyway. Could we just for once have freedom?
And we're supportive of the idea of estimating selling prices. It's just that for certain products, we believe that we need a residual method.
Under a big time on BDO. A lot of our discussion focused around the high and low margin items that have been raised by a number of others. I think we also went into the slightly more extreme version of it, where you can find that there is a loss leader sale where a company is actually making a loss on that component in the knowledge that it will recoup all of the money in subsequent sales. And so when you start to look at these ones, the relative selling price isn't necessarily something that gives you the best answer. And certainly in our discussion, we then focused much more on what the relative profit margins were, if it was possible to identify those. And you might find that there was one way of getting there where you could have something where the sales price might be a practical expedient, unless you've got something which demonstrates that you've got different margins involved. Because once you've got different margins involved, I think the sales price doesn't work very well. So it's just trying to get into the more extreme ends of the scale to try and find something that would give you a solution over the wider range.
Okay.
One topic that there wasn't a specific question asked in the exposure draft, but which has been mentioned in a number of comment letters, relates to onerous performance obligations. Now, the ED proposes that an entity would recognize a liability and an expense if a performance obligation were onerous. And that, I think, has caused people concern in some respects, because some respondents have said that they believe that the onerous test should be done at the contract level rather than at the performance obligation level, which is a view held, I think, by a number of you in the room. I don't know if anyone would like to raise any points with the board members.
At least once I have to use the buzzword cross-cutting issue, and I might just well do it here, because we seem to have a number of projects right now where we have different levels where we go into the onerous bit. Segmenting even, or at a contract level, or even going to a portfolio. And you might have very good arguments for each and every one, but it seems to be very difficult that on revenue recognition you go one way, on leases you go another way, and on certain other financial instrument or financial instrument close projects you go even to the portfolio level. And somehow, I don't think you have convinced us yet, regardless which way.
What does it take to convince you?
We talk about it.
I think I would also agree that possibly carrying out the onerous test at the contract level makes some sense, because at the contract inception or before you enter into the contract, possibly the company has, you know, negotiated overall package, and if you might have something like a loss leader or something within that package, then I think it does not adequately reflect what is effectively happening. And we have the situation that we don't have a symmetry, so we would not recognize something related to the positive elements that relate to other performance obligations. And the same applies if you roll forward that contract. You won't have any offsetting effect if you look at the separate performance obligations, and I think that is why we prefer the contract level.
I have a lot of understanding for that until you come to big complex contracts, right, where you can say that you would like to see the whole contract of building a city, and you're seeing that as a contract, and the first house and the second house is losses. But where and when do you break it up?
Well, I think if you build a power plant, then the management focuses on the power plant. That is how you would internally also report and control that project. So you would report the overall margin on the project to the top management, but you would not direct, you would not report to the top management that a small performance obligation, for example, is onerous now. So I think that is, from my perspective, the right view because it provides a sensible answer somehow.
Construction companies building three buildings like this, they like to see it as one contract. Years in between delivering the three buildings.
I mean, to be honest, I have discussed that issue, you know, during my time I was here, and I was somehow inclined to say that it makes sense to break it down. But having looked at real big contracts, I think it makes sense. And obviously, Jan, you're right that where do you stop? I mean, why would you then not link buildings that are very, very similar and that are within different contracts, why would you not link that? But, so I think at some point you have to make an arbitrary choice, and I think the arbitrary choice that makes the most sense is the contract level.
François Flores, IFRAC. To follow up on what has been said, IFRAC also does not support having onerous losses on performance obligation within an overall profitable construct. And to follow up on the issue of the three buildings being built over a period of years, I guess if the first building, if the contract had been just for one building, probably the price would have been higher. So if you would recognize losses on the first of a series of three that has been negotiated as a package of three, you would not reflect economic reality now, do you? And to follow up on the on this issue and connect it to the previous one, in fact, we have in our discussion moved from supporting the standalone selling price to supporting the standalone selling margins in order to alleviate the issue of onerous performance obligations.
Just to say that I agree with what Francoise and Nicholas have said about onerous contracts. The most significant point is it makes no sense to me to recognise a loss at the point of entering into a contract that's profitable overall. The price of the contract as a whole has been negotiated. That's not a loss-making event. On the particular question that you raised of three buildings, I guess I would clarify that the level of the contract is the contract that you ended up with when you'd applied stage one of your five-stage process. In other words, it might be after segmenting something. It might, in some cases, be after combining what are two separate legal contracts. That seems to be the right level at which to apply it. But thereafter, that's, I think, the right unit for count. I don't think that the individual performance obligation is the right unit for count.
Similarly, we would support performing the assessment at the contract level. I think we just didn't understand what useful information was being provided by recognising a loss at the inception of a profitable contract. If board members or other constituents can show that there is some useful information in recognising a loss on entering into a profitable contract, you know, happens to debate the argument, we just didn't understand why that was valuable. The three building example, I think, is a very interesting question. And it also must put you back to, as Phil was saying, what's the definition of the contract? It seems to me that if the contract is defined by reference to pricing, then that's the right level to be recognising an onerous obligation. One additional point I'd like to make about identification and measurement of onerous obligations is the interaction with proposals on pricing. We felt quite uncomfortable with the idea that an entity might enter into an arrangement in the hope and expectation that it would be valuable to the business, but there was uncertainty about the measurement of, for example, variable consideration. And it wasn't clear to us that an entity should necessarily recognise a loss on inception,
really because the threshold that's been set for variable consideration, and we wondered if the way to deal with that would be to have some kind of recognition threshold, something like a sort of set in light for the recognition of onerous obligations, irrespective of whether they were at the performance obligation or contract level.
Echo the concerns about the level at which you recognise the onerous contract, and perhaps a way to address it is that the separate identification of the performance obligations is for revenue recognition purposes. So to figure out, have I done what I had to do to earn this piece of revenue, I identify a performance obligation. But when assessing whether my contract as a whole is onerous, it's a different obligation that I'm looking at, so that to me, the onerous contract or the onerous liability is an IAS 37 liability. The performance obligation and the revenue standard is an obligation I have to do something to earn revenue. I think they're two different things. And I think that's why you could justify assessing the onerous contract at a different level.
Okay. Nothing else on this topic?
Yes. I have a larger issue here, which is not necessarily related to this particular issue on revenue law. But when we talk about the value relevance of the standards, any information which the companies provide, you want to make that information value relevant to the investor and other stakeholder. So often a question arises, particularly with respect to the revenue, will disaggregating the revenue information be value relevant at all? Will it serve the investor more information than just combining them to it? Is investors interested in that information? Some of the well-known research papers are now actually shown that by default, revenue is a relevant information to the investor. But the disaggregation of revenue is not so relevant. So is that going to influence this particular issue, that is it necessary to disaggregate or not?
Move on.
Okay, the final topic which a number of you have in common in your comment letters relates to contract modifications. The EV proposes that the entity would account for contract modifications together with the original contract if the prices of the modification and the existing contract are interdependent. And I think perhaps that sort of general guiding principle is generally accepted. Where people are raising the issue in comment letters is where we deal with the effect of subsequent changes in the estimation of the transaction price, where if you decide that the modification is part of the original contract and you bundle the two together, to the extent that a discount or a variable transaction price changes subsequently, that would be backdated to the prior performance obligation. Which is exemplified, I think, in example 2 in the discussion paper, the exposure draft. I don't know if anyone has any particular comments on contract modification under the proposal.
Again, this is something we've talked about before, but I'm happy with the interdependence as the test for whether you've got to do some thinking. The problem is then that the ED gives you the impression that there is just a very strict methodology that you then apply. It produces some very odd results in some cases. In particular, if you have a contract to supply the same thing for several years at an agreed price and you've got your known costs and everything should be panning out quite straightforwardly, and then later on your costs jump and as a result you go back to your customer and negotiate a price increase, and they concede an increase but not all the way up to the new market price. It's clearly interdependent. The oddity of the approach in the ED is that you appear then to be better off as a result of making a smaller margin. You actually accelerate some revenue into the earlier years and at the expense of future years, which actually become loss-making, even though potentially you've got an example where actually you do make profits all the way through, just much smaller ones in later years. I could write this on a flip chart, but effectively it gives a very odd answer. We're quite sceptical that you can actually mandate a methodology that would cover all modifications. What we would encourage instead is that you think about the most common scenarios that give rise to modifications and suggest appropriate methodologies for each of those so that you're encouraging some kind of consistency but without producing answers that just don't appear to reflect the economics. I'm sorry, it's quite hard to explain merely with words why that doesn't work, but I can give you an example at some point if that's helpful.
Francis Flores, IFRAC. On that issue, we have basically made two comments. The first one is that we have supported the interdependency being the branches of the site, but we believe the guidance needs more clarity. I don't think we would, the example that you've given, Phil, I guess we would see that if the entity has the ability to renegotiate, that it would in fact be the sign that the two sets of two performance obligations do no longer belong to the same contract. If it is just a question of resetting the price, but you may grant discounts for various reasons, sometimes just to make forget that you have in the last delivery performed, for example. So basically our recommendation has been to that the standard would say to consider all facts and circumstances and of course justify why you do things in a way, but at least reflect what the change has been and why it's been made.
Just Andrew Buchanan, BDO, just to add our voice, that we also are supportive of the idea of interdependence. As we've said in our comment letter, we think there's perhaps a little bit more work needed to give a bit more clarity around just when interdependence arises and when it doesn't. But as a concept, I think it's operational. We didn't discuss it in great detail, but Phil's point is interesting in that you might have a number of different approaches depending on the precise facts of different contexts. And I think that's certainly worth exploring and seeing whether it would be possible to give some additional guidance within the application guidance to the final standard itself.
Okay.
I guess one of the concerns with contract modification as it would currently play out under the ED is effectively Phil, your point about that it so often is going to result in a sort of a retrospective change to the previous accounting, and that's perhaps the real problem here. I was just going to ask, in having thought through some of the scenarios, but have you got a type of example where you'd say that having a retrospective change would be appropriate, or would you see that really as the exception? Generally, you'd expect the accounting to be to deal with the modification prospectively.
I haven't come up with any examples where I think it's obvious that retrospective is the only right answer. There is some where prospective appears to be the only thing that makes much sense, and others where you might be able to argue it either way. For example, if you have a contract originally and everything's agreed and there's no change to your costs, but the customer just comes back later on and says, you know what, even though we have contracts, if you want to carry on doing business with me, you're going to give me a 10% discount on the whole thing, maybe that is retrospective. On the other hand, those sort of circumstances, and we're seeing some of them in the UK at the moment maybe, arguably are driven by changes in the market that happened partway through the contract. So I can see an argument that even that is really prospective. So no, I don't immediately see anything that's automatically retrospective.
Okay. Shall we turn to more open questions?
We have left quite a bit of time at the end of this session because there are a range of other comments which some of you have made just sort of individually, which we'd obviously be interested in hearing, things like disclosure, transition, and other aspects which are covered in the proposed standard. So perhaps it might be appropriate if we went round the table and you could give any general comments or closing remarks or indeed raise topics which are of concern to you individually. Start with perhaps Nico and...
Okay. Actually, regarding the disclosure requirements, we think
how shall I say it, I think it's not easy to apply those disclosure requirements, and particularly I think you might require preparers to present a time pattern when the performance obligations will be satisfied in the future. And I mean, if you think of a power plant again, I mean, that power plant, when you perform the last performance obligations, that might be within 8-10 years, and the deviation are quite significant in real life. So it might be sometimes in 15 years, and if you're lucky, you might be there in 8 years. And I think providing that information to investors, I don't know if it's really decision useful, because there's so much uncertainty around that, and you will definitely have a different pattern next year, and possibly will be very difficult to always explain what exactly happened to the public. In other words, would you possibly reflect a certainty about when you perform your obligations, if you have that pattern that will never be met, and whether you would raise an expectation in the market and that you will probably not meet. So we would possibly say we can see that there's some sensibility in providing information about performance obligations in the future, but we would not narrow that down and basically saying that you have to show which performance obligation is satisfied in which year in the future. So we'd rather have a broader statement or a broader disclosure about that.
And for the purposes of this open session, if any of you have something to contribute to another person's topic, then feel free to catch Jan's eye.
As the point that Nicholas has raised is one of the ones that I was hoping to raise anyway, we share those concerns. Paragraph 78 asks you to forecast when you will meet performance obligations. It seems to us that there are many cases where that outcome is far from within the control of the seller. It's very difficult to predict. It's equally difficult to audit. It looks dangerously like some sort of profit forecast, and seems like the kind of thing that might expose reporting entities to risk in some cases that on the whole we just don't think is appropriate. So while we can see that sort of forward-looking information may in some cases be quite useful to users, we're really not persuaded that it belongs in the audited part of the financial statements. It seems to us that it probably belongs in the front half instead.
Andrew Buchanan, BDO. Much the point that I was going to bring up as well. We had significant concerns over the uncertainties, particularly when the actual outcomes and the timing of revenue recognition is out with the control of the selling entity. And so we wondered about the ultimate value of what was being given. I think when you look at the forecast information, in particular on the more medium-sized listed entities, if you combine the proposed disclosure with the segmental disclosures that these entities are required to make, then you get very much to Phil's points, which we have as well, which is you're getting very, very close to something where if it's not explicitly there, it's very, very easy to get to a proper forecast for that entity.
Okay, did you have any other topics you wanted to raise?
I think that was one main issue.
Can I come in on that? This bit about the difficulty. I mean, I don't see it as a profit forecast. I mean, you're not asking for a forecast of new contracts. I mean, the contracts exist. And this uncertainty over timing, I mean, there are many more uncertain amounts that you do audit. I'm not quite sure what the sensitivity is for this particular item. We had a guy this morning from the construction industry that seemed to think it was a highly relevant piece of information and he didn't have a problem with it. Did I misinterpret what he said this morning?
No, I wouldn't dispute that it might be very interesting to people and may well be useful. I can't immediately think of any other forecasts that we put into accounts. We certainly do sometimes forecast cash flows, for example, for the purpose of impairment testing. We don't usually publish the forecasts that we're using. So I don't see... You're analogising something...
Forecasting all over the place. I mean, forecasts of value financial instruments and all sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, that are disclosed.
Asset retirement obligations.
Okay, well...
Pensions.
And just all three.
I guess I'm not close enough to financial instruments to disagree with you, but I'm not aware that we put in forecasts that relate to goodwill or that we put in forecasts that relate to pensions. We may look forward for assessment of recoverability, but that's a completely different thing from actually putting in some numbers about what's going to happen in the future.
No, you forecast cash flows in order to come up with a fair value estimate.
But you don't publish
the forecast. It's embedded, forget about the forecast, it's embedded in the value of the financial instrument.
Yes.
If you apply IAS 37, that's exactly what you're doing. They're future cash flows. They're uncertain future cash flows. Put a number on the financial statement.
I agree that you use forecasts to measure items. I don't agree that you publish forecasts. I do think there's a difference between the two.
We know your point. Did you want to come in, Ruth?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Sorry, the only other point I wanted to make on disclosures is there seems to be some concern, certainly amongst the companies that we've spoken with. It's not clear to them whether the ED is expecting them to publish their order book or the contracts that have started. So outside the construction industry, just your normal sort of manufacturing company, are the disclosure requirements applying just to the order book, even if no work has begun on the order? So it's completely an executory contract, in other words. Is disclosure expected of that? We weren't sure what you were getting at.
Anything else, Nicole?
I think I agree with Phil basically saying I understand that basically what we are doing is a DCF model somehow, and we would apply that to many situations, to financial instruments, IAS 37 as a retirement obligation. I agree on that. But I agree with Phil that having that calculation and possibly coming up with a value and disclosing and recognizing that value and exactly showing the pattern that how you came to that value is still a different thing.
But it's not a value. We're not asking for you to value your business or value these contracts.
But you would ask us to say, well, if you build a power plant, when exactly would you have your cash flows?
When will you satisfy the performance obligations?
Possibly a link to the cash flow.
So, Nico, anything else you'd like to bring up?
No.
Okay. Amana.
Thank you. So, I also continue with this point on the disclosure with respect to the cash flows, not necessarily for a construction company. I see a huge value relevance of the cash flow information on the financial statements. But the nomenclature, which is often we use as a cash from operating or operating cash flows, it would be nice if we come out with something called the free cash flows, which the finance world extensively uses. So from a company's point of view, even if you are not valuing for the company, but as a user, I would like to understand what is the free cash flow available for the firm point of view. So therefore, there is a need, because I could see there is a movement of accounting towards convergence toward the finance world. But somehow or other we are consciously avoiding the words which the finance world is using. For example, how to diminish the gap between accounting cash flows and economic or a free cash flow. So some thought can get into that. That is one. The second one, not from the investors, but from the manager and internal manager's point of view. For example, are all customers equally profitable? Are all products equally profitable? These are a very important information for a manager's point of view. But unfortunately, accounting as it is not able to answer that. I'm just sharing with Nicholas some of the case studies which we use with respect to Siemens. A large number of studies which we do to understand whether all these customers and products are equally profitable or not. But unfortunately, financial statements are not answering that. Can we make financial statements more relevant by making them to enable to answer this question? I think revenue recognition is one particular standard which can contribute to that process, combining with the segment reporting. But I don't know how it can pitch into in which question.
I have another project for that.
Thanks very much. That's all.
Just a couple of other points. One on costs. We don't believe that a standard on revenue should deal with costs. We believe that a standard on costs or assets should be understand why it's in here, but still think that it should the adjustments should preferably be made to the other standards on inventory, et cetera, and intangibles rather than in the revenue standards. The other point is about field testing, and this is half a question, half a recommendation. Given that there are a number of concerns around the control model and the continuous transfer and other things that we've raised together, we do hear a lot of noise about the standard, and it's not positive noise. And the noise that we hear is that industries don't feel they can implement it. And whether it's because they haven't tried to or they haven't, they are used to in the US, for example, having much more guidance than now, that the risk is that that guidance is going to be taken away from them. They're very concerned about it. So we would certainly recommend a lot more time to be spent on the field testing of these proposals with specific industries. And the question is whether you're planning to do that or whether you've started that already.
We haven't put together a detailed project plan at this stage. We're waiting for the finalisation of the analysis of the comment letters. And when we get to that stage, we'll see what is the appropriate sort of level for the boards to take it to constituents to test.
I think, Ruth, I hear what you say, Ruth, but for us to, I think, react to that in a sensible way, we'd need to have some idea as to exactly what it is you think we need to field test. Because, you know, we can spend a lot of time polishing and giving ourselves a high level of comfort that this can be applied. I think that that's desirable in a perfect world. But I think, you know, we have a situation where we have an ED in place, which I think generally is receiving fairly positive support. Some nervousness about how it might be applied in a variety of situations, but I think it's pointless to undertake endless field tests. We'd need to have them very targeted, in my view. So the extent to which those that are expressing those concerns can give us feedback as to exactly what it is that is concerning them, that would be very helpful.
I think we've got some in the letters.
And we certainly, we're very happy to help, and we're happy to work with you and identify where the concern is coming from. So very happy to help.
Okay.
We were allowed to jump in when we wanted to follow up. So that's François Flores, IFRAC, and I would like to bring support to this recommendation, maybe try to give a beginning of an answer to Rowan's questions. I would say two areas. I mean, it's going to be maybe a bit imprecise, but I see two major areas of concern. The first one is for those industries that believe that the proposals would lead them into communicating with their investor community on the basis of non-GAAP, because some of them clearly, if the proposals were not adjusted significantly to allow them to do something similar, in fact, to what they're doing today, maybe not exactly the same, but something similar that could reflect their performance, the way they carry their activity in as relevant a fashion as today. In fact, should be improved. They would continue to manage their business the way they do it and communicate with the analysts on the basis of that, what would have become non-GAAP information. And that would be very detrimental, we think, to IFRS in general and this industry in particular. So one area of field testing would be probably to see representatives of industries accompanied by the analysts, and see whether what needs to be done, whether it's adjustment to what you have proposed or whether it's a more radical change in some areas, so that this evolution does not happen. The other areas is where, in fact, the proposals trying to reach a higher level of sophistication of estimates, in fact generates the need for changing systems dramatically, maybe for an incremental benefit to users, which is not necessarily completely supported by evidence. And so make your project in the end, the final standard, maybe less ambitious than it is still at present. And field testing, going beyond, you know, the outreach activities where messages pass, but you don't have evidence of what is being told to you, that would be substantiated in a greater extent. That we acknowledge that in making this kind of recommendations, we bring delays in the finalization of the standard. But it is a very important standard. I mean, everybody understands that revenue is important. And we really strongly support that a series of supplementary months be allocated to that field testing exercise, and if needed, some maybe partial re-exposure if needed.
Yeah, I just think it's important to understand what field tests actually are. From what I heard, Francoise, maybe I misunderstood it, but I think much of what you, I think, may be concerned about would be dealt with in terms of the period of transition. I think you've heard the board say on major projects we wouldn't be requiring the new standards to be effective for at least 2 years, and we're putting out a request for views on effective dates, early adoption and so on. We've also said for those standards where there would be significant systems implications, the period of transition could be longer. That provides an opportunity for the sorts of discussions that you pointed to be undertaken. Our understanding of field testing is that you're endeavouring to try and understand whether the proposals that you have developed are understandable, whether they can be applied appropriately in practice. It gives us important feedback in terms of our cost-benefit analysis and so on. If we're going to undertake the sort of field tests we understand, we need to understand what those areas are that we need to focus on in terms of those aspects. So I don't think you were talking about field tests as we'd understand.
Well, I would say yes. I suppose in the volume of letters that you've received and the extent of the outreach activities that have been performed, I would tend to think that you have a rather good idea of the areas that people have already mentioned to you. And the thing is to bring some flesh to those issues. And in terms of you seeing the solution as being just, you know, take your time to implement the standard, I mean, we finalize our decision and take your time, that doesn't bring the benefits of field testing, because the benefit of field testing is to help you revisit the incremental changes that you have promoted that may be, the ones that require the biggest effort. And without having the evidence as of today, that the benefit is going to be that great to users.
Steve, you want to come in?
François, another point you mentioned was that you felt that we need to keep the outcomes, the answers, similar to what we have today, and that if we don't do that, then we're going to have non-gap information and disaster. And yet we had the guy from Vivendi this morning saying that the current gap on his sales of games doesn't reflect the underlying economics, and that the new ED would. So that would be a change, and presumably he's not going to give non-gap information going back to the old system.
I didn't suggest in any way, I'm sorry if I expressed myself badly, that in every circumstance the proposals in the EZ would not provide a relevant answer. In fact, we believe it would in many cases. We care very, very much for the cases where it would not, and we believe that these should be appropriately dealt with. And we have not denied that some improvements could be brought by the proposals. So the fact that there remains possibly industries that would be left out of a relevant measurement, a relevant recognition of their revenue, is sufficient to concern, even if 85% of the population is satisfied, and even if they have improved their revenue pattern overall. So the fact that you have positive cases does not deny the importance of solving the arrears where there are concerns.
I thought you were suggesting that any change would not be positive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we move on.
Yes, just to, I support an awful lot of what Françoise was saying there, particularly the idea that this is important enough to get right. Warren's question, where should you be focusing this? You should be focusing it on those areas that were not sufficiently clear at the discussion paper stage or at the ED stage, which is the meaning of control, particularly for professional services. That may not necessarily involve what you might call field tests. It might just involve outreach discussions. But at the moment, I don't know what you propose for those. So I'm not in any position to know whether it's going to work.
Let's pick up. The ball is still with you, so you can continue this or finalise your...
On the field testing suggestion, I think it's jurisdictional, and I'm particularly here thinking about the US. We're dealing with two completely different backgrounds moving to a new standard. The IFRS background is quite used to dealing with a very small standard with not a lot of guidance in it, and has figured out a way to deal with it. Whether it's right or not is a different issue, but it's figured out a way to work with a small standard with a bit of guidance. The US background is coming from a completely different place where they've got detailed industry-based standards. And so my suggestion would be that it's where those industry standards are, or the guidance is, where the US is most concerned, because they're not sure what this means for them. They don't know. If they throw out their industry guidance, does it mean that they change or they don't change? They don't know. And that's where I'm suggesting that you put some of your effort in focus.
Any other topic you would like to mention or final comment?
Me? Yeah. No.
Okay. We'll take that as that you're encouraging us. Brian?
Thank you. We support this project. I can say that very clearly. We can see that a huge amount of work has been done and a huge amount of progress has been made since the discussion paper stage. I have to say I would compliment staff on the exposure. I think that having such a polished due process document has helped raise the standard of debate. I'm very grateful for that. And I also applaud the extent of outreach that the board undertook between the discussion paper and exposure draft stages. But I do want to come back to this point about what needs to be done to have a final standard that can be applied consistently. Some of the points we've discussed today, like whether or not an onerous obligation should be identified at the performance obligation or contract level, seem almost to be a binary decision. There's a decision to be made around the decision usefulness of the information and the ability of people to make the assessment. And I think whichever of those two alternatives you chose, I suspect I would know what to do, and I suspect most preparers would know what to do. In contrast, the transfer of control concept, which we support as a concept, was a major theme of this discussion, and I think there needs to be, at the minimum, a re-articulation of that concept, perhaps slightly more than that, and I would have thought that before moving to having a final standard, it would be absolutely essential that you had comfort that the generality of preparers would know precisely how to apply that re-articulated concept. So for me, that is a key remaining task, and in part going to highlight one thing that would come under the umbrella of field testing. It would be that, and perhaps there will be one or two other similar areas as a reference earlier to under distinct forms obligations about whether construction contract accounting will become a free-for-all to the extent that you revisit distinct criteria. I think that would be another area to field test. I think there are specific things to be looked at in a little more detail, and I would encourage you to do that with a broad range of constituents before publishing a final standard.
Ethan?
One footnote, so to speak, to what Ruth said. I think the volume of guidance doesn't necessarily cut between US GAAP and IFRS, because some of the US GAAP guidance has been used to fill up IS 18, and it's specific in some industry areas, and so the fight for more or less guidance is across, I think. It isn't geographically or GAAP-based, but that was just a footnote. I guess at some stage we could talk about transition, but we need not, but it's the, I think, more or less usual debate about the retrospective being theoretically the pure way, but with limits and so forth. But we don't have to go into details on my part on that. There's just one final thought. What remains? I mean, we now are probably getting a revenue recognition standard where you have contracts with a customer. We do have some occurrences in life, like dividend payments, where we have the odd bit of guidance here and there in relation to IS 18. So if you withdraw IS 18 and come up with a standard on contracts with customers, there is something left to be done one of these days. And I guess sooner or later, because you have sort of an interpretation somewhere which has hinged on IS 18 referring to dividend payments or other payments, so there is some cleanup around to be done.
You know, I already delivered a lot of what I wanted to deliver, so I don't want to insist too much, but to go beyond the avoidance of doubt, I think our comment letter, and I hope some of my remarks during this session do support a lot of aspects that to us we see as a potential for solving, in fact, a lot of the issues that were identified as starting points. So I certainly don't want this positive note to be forgotten. And I would be also glad to say express how grateful we are to the team with whom we have enjoyed a very, very constructive working relationship, and we're very grateful for that.
Okay, Eric. I think I also wanted to express our respect for the quality of the work that's been produced, and also our appreciation of the opportunity to contribute to that process and the constructive working relationship we've had towards the process. The last thing I wanted to comment on is transition. As a group, we're a group of seven companies. We couldn't come up with consensus on transition provisions. The only message we have, some of us were in favor of full retrospective, others prospective, others modified prospective, for whatever this is. The point is, this is major to our systems, this is major to our business models. We need time. And that's basically our last message. We do need a lot of time once the standard is finalized to prepare ourselves. And evidently, we need more time if the full retrospective is the approach which is retained.
Thank you. I'll add our support in relation to the EG. In our comment letter, there are areas that we ask about, but the overriding comment we have is our support for the broad principles in the EG. I think this, in common with others, if the clarifications that we talked about could come through, and that would be very helpful. But overall, we see a very good quality due process document, and something which is very likely to end up being very substantially better accounting standard than where we are now. So that's very welcome. I would agree that it would be helpful on the areas where we've said today it's maybe not particularly clear, there's additional analysis needed, additional work done. It'll be useful to test that quite carefully, not just in terms of its operationality, but also to run a cross-check to see whether if someone did want a different answer from what's substantially really the same thing, could they structure around to get it? Because that's when you've got a really strong principle, when you can't structure around it. And I'm not absolutely sure we've got there in all of the proposals at the moment. For transition, I think we're in a place where many people in our organisation would support retrospective. There are others that have a different view. I suspect in a way it will all get bound up into the request for views and what will happen with the wide range of standards that will come through, both in terms of to what extent is it fully retrospective, but also what the actual final implementation dates might be and how far out they go. Because in a way, if you give people a little bit longer before the mandatory date, then it's easier to get full retrospective adoption.
I'd echo all the comments made about the quality of the work done and the efforts made by the team. It's very much appreciated. It seems to me that this is an incredibly difficult subject to deal with, and the work that's been done so far is really of an exceptionally high quality. The fact that we've disagreed with quite a lot of it is not a reflection of its quality. It has brought out the right issues. There are real questions to ask on those issues. So that's in no way a criticism of the work done, and we do appreciate very much the efforts that teams have gone to in terms of outreach. And we do very much support the approach that's been taken. We would like to see it reach its logical conclusion and get the best possible outcome. There is, I'm sure this is against the spirit of things winding up, but I do have one specific technical question to raise with you, which is around royalties, really. It's not completely clear to me from the ED whether you might expect to bring in royalties that a customer is not yet obliged to pay. Our view would be that you shouldn't. If I give an example, I may be a manufacturer, I may have the right to use somebody else's IP in my product, and each time I sell one of those products, I may be obliged to pay a royalty to the person who holds that IP. It seems to me that it is not appropriate for the holder of that IP to anticipate revenues based on sales I have not yet made and that I'm not yet obliged to make. But it's not completely clear to me where the ED is on that.
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you all for giving these valuable comments and contributions. I sense from your comments that there are some good things and some things to continue to work upon. Still, that the direction is more or less right. A matter of some urgency for us will be to then take home what you said about this with field testing or whatever we should call it to see if this works in a number of industries. And here I would really support the team and all of you to try to give us a little bit more of a direct indication of what is it and where is it and can we go there and look for it so we can really take this into reality. We have more than 200 events with different companies, organizations, and so forth. But to go into this will be very critical for us then to assess that topic as we still have this ambition of closing this mid-2011. I think we should only do that when we have a solid base of doing it. That's my personal view. I hope everyone agrees. But it's important that we get, as soon as possible, a little bit more of ideas of how to move that forward. So thank you for coming. Thank you for participating. We'll talk more about this a little later.
Yeah.
Bye.
Thank you.